This is Free Speech Radio News for October 19th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, continuing violence in the Middle East as time runs out for the latest ceasefire. The Nigerian military cracks down on villagers in its oil-rich regions, while newly merged Chevron and Texaco want to export more oil from that country to the United States. And the nation's leading progressive radio network tries to gut the political content of Democracy Now!, its most popular show. Any positive effects of the ceasefire brokered by Israeli and Palestinian negotiators at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, earlier this week, may soon be erased by a resurgence of violence. Despite the Israeli army's pullback of tanks from the borders of Palestinian-controlled towns and the Palestinian authorities' rearrest of Islamic militants, it appears unlikely that today's deadline for cessation of hostilities and resumption of talks will be met. On Thursday, Israeli army helicopters... Any positive effects of the ceasefire brokered by Israeli and Palestinian negotiators at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, earlier this week, may soon be erased by a resurgence of violence. Despite the Israeli army's pullback of tanks from the borders of Palestinian-controlled towns and the Palestinian authorities' rearrest of Islamic militants, it appears unlikely that today's deadline for cessation of hostilities and resumption of talks will be met. On Thursday, Israeli army helicopters fired on Palestinian police and gunmen in Nablus, killing one Palestinian and leaving three others wounded. The death toll from nearly 3 weeks of clashes is now over 100, nearly all of them Palestinians. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat has been criticized for failing to make a public call for Palestinians to end the unrest in the occupied territories. But Robert Fisk, Beirut correspondent for the Independent of London, says those criticisms frame the issues unfairly.
All these questions about, you know, can Arafat keep control? Is Arafat in charge? Has to be balanced by an equal question. Can Barak keep control? A Jewish Israeli mob ransacked and burned a restaurant in Tel Aviv, attempting to burn alive the Arab waiters. Did Barak order that? No, of course he didn't. Ehud Barak was not involved. He didn't have control. We have numerous cases of Jewish settlers murdering Palestinian civilians. Barak was not in control.
Fisk says the recent wave of Palestinian protest is not so much a threat to the peace process, but a symptom that it's already dead. Arafat's decision to neither applaud the uprising nor call for its cessation may simply be his attempt to make the best of a difficult situation.
Arafat realizes that he is trapped politically. He thinks he has been double-crossed. He knows that there is an enormous amount of anger, in his view no doubt justified, against the Israelis, and he is prepared to allow that anger to be demonstrated manifold on the streets against the Israelis.
But Arafat's silence has been frustrating for Palestinians as well. Barbara Lubin is with the Middle East Children's Alliance, an American group which provides medical assistance to Palestinian children. She's in the West Bank town of Ramallah and says the situation among Palestinians is the worst she's seen in 13 years of visits to the occupied territories.
The tension here is like unlike I've ever seen it. Even during all those years of the Intifada, it was never like this. There were politics then. There was leadership then. There were women's committees. There was organizing. There's nothing now. There's just anger and frustration and sadness.
Ramallah was brought into the headlines last week by the mob killing of two Israeli soldiers and the ensuing Israeli rocket attacks on Palestinian Authority offices. On this day, however, Lubin attended the kind of demonstration which has received much less attention in the international press. A group of Palestinian doctors and nurses called on the Israeli army to stop shooting at ambulance drivers and medics who are giving aid to the wounded. Two Palestinian ambulance drivers have been killed in such attacks. If the violence continues, the future could be even more bleak for Palestinians. Barak and Israeli military aides are discussing a radical plan to seal off Palestinian-ruled areas permanently. Palestinian officials call that idea racist. This week's merger of U.S. oil giants Chevron and Texaco has been evaluated for its effects on consumers and on the 4,000 workers who are expected to lose their jobs. But within the oil industry, analysts say the deal would boost the newly formed company's profits by making it easier to access its resources in West Africa, particularly in Nigeria. During his visit to the country last month, U.S. President Clinton and Nigerian President Obasanjo agreed to dramatically increase oil exports from Nigeria to the U.S. And since then, the Nigerian military has been cracking down. Sam Olakoya reports from the Niger Delta.
Thousands of new government troops and paramilitary forces have been deployed to the oil-rich Niger Delta as the Nigerian government plans to increase oil production. The bulk of the oil will be exported to the United States. The Nigerian government says the deployment is meant to protect oil installations, but Patterson Ogun, director of the Ijaw Council for Human Rights, says the deployment goes beyond the protection of oil installations. In the last 6 years, thousands of villagers have been killed in the Niger Delta following military actions ordered by successive governments desperate to keep oil flowing out of the area.
It amounts to state robbery for the Nigerian government to begin to think that the only way it can exploit for oil in the Niger Delta is to send down troops to the local communities, harass people, maim people, kill people, and continue to leave the crude, you know, by violence. This is what it amounts to. It amounts to state robbery of the peoples of the resources of the peoples of the Niger Delta.
Oronto Douglas is leader of the Chikoko movement, a group resisting the harsh effects of oil exploitation in the Niger Delta. He attributes the recent military deployments to the Niger Delta to plans to increase oil output by 1 million barrels a day. He says the United States, which will be the main beneficiary of this, is anxious to see more oil flowing out of the Niger Delta.
Early this year, about March or so, there was a simulated program organized by the CIA and the State Department to try to envisage a situation where there is a problem in the Delta, where if oil does not flow out, how can the United States continue to ensure that oil flows uninterruptedly?
Oronto Douglas says the United States is particularly interested in increasing oil imports from Nigeria because Nigerian oil is among the cleanest burning in the world.
Nigeria's crude is sweet crude, as they say, meaning that it is low in content, low in sulfur content, highly inflammable. It is desired by refineries as a result of the low environmental impact resulting from the pressure environmentalists and human rights activists are putting on the oil companies worldwide to become more environmentally friendly. So the attraction to Nigeria's crude is based on environmental consideration, the fact that it is cheaper to lift crude from the Niger Delta to the United States.
The democratic government in Nigeria has relied on the military and the police to keep oil flowing out of the Niger Delta since it came to power. Last week, 300 U.S. soldiers arrived in Nigeria to train officers. Villagers in the Niger Delta fear the Nigerian military will use that training to crack down on communities in the oil-rich region. Oronto Douglas opposes the military aid.
America believes in democracy, but abroad, it is doubtful whether America is practicing democracy. I think that democracy must be transparent, it must be just, it must take into cognizance the wishes and aspirations of the people. The American government have demonstrated that they do not understand Nigeria. If they truly understand Nigeria, they will not side with the oppressors to, you know, to put down our people.
The people are indeed being put down by the recent deployment of troops and paramilitary police. Late last month, paramilitary policemen attacked Egborode village with assault rifles, machine guns, and machetes.
Six vehicles loaded with a MOBA came to the outskirt of Egborode. Immediately, they came in, they advanced into the community, destroyed houses, burned people's properties, they destroyed the whole community, wasted the time for the destruction for about 2 hours before they went away.
The village was attacked following allegations by the Nigerian government that the villagers ruptured an oil pipeline. Although there is no independent verification that the villagers carried out the act, the attack on the village sent out a clear signal from the Nigerian government that it will take strong measures to keep oil flowing out of the Niger Delta to fulfill its agreement to export more oil to the United States. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Sam Olukoya in the Niger Delta.
After a 32-day driver's strike, public buses in Los Angeles are back on the road. On Tuesday, drivers overwhelmingly approved a new contract negotiated with the help of Jesse Jackson. The union movement says the strike demonstrated its strength, and it says it will remember its friends in the struggle and punish its enemies. Robin Yurovich reports from Los Angeles.
Some 2,000 bus drivers and their families packed the LA Convention Center to vote on a 3-year contract offer. It passed overwhelmingly.
Today, you are better off than you were 32 days ago.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson brokered the deal that gives drivers about 8.3% increases over 3 years. He turned the ratification meeting into part prayer service, part rally.
And what you prove is you fight for your middle-class jobs, as you fight to buy your home, as you fight to educate your children. That is the American dream.
Union leaders say the strike was about preserving pension, health care, and job security in the face of cost-cutting demands by the MTA. It was a bitter fight, says Union President James Williams.
They wanted to create a property of part-time employment at $10 an hour. This was, and make no mistake about it, union busting at its best with millions of dollars to pull it off, and we stayed the course.
The strike was a test of LA's resurgent labor movement. Union leaders were able to pull in Jesse Jackson as a mediator, and they marshaled a lot of political clout and community support. African-American ministers supported the drivers' call to keep good jobs for the primarily black and Latino workforce. And members of LA's bus riders union joined picket lines. About a dozen senators and assembly members held a public hearing on the MTA. Now, State Senator Richard Alarcón says he'll introduce legislation to make 6 of 13 board slots elected positions.
We think that the board needs to be held more accountable. We have to question some of the poor investments that the MTA made, which are causing the debt problems, which caused them to keep trying to take away from the bus system, which is the primary mass transit system in Los Angeles.
Union leaders say whether or not there's an elected board in 3 years, they'll work to oust board members who they say led union busting efforts. That's one way to keep the MTA from chipping away at driver pay and benefits, says County Federation of Labor head Miguel Contreras.
Because all those elected officials who then side with working families are going to be held accountable. Are going to be held accountable. And we'll ask them when they come to the unions and ask for support, we're going to say, where were you? Where were you in the strike at the MTA?
For its part, the MTA board, led by Mayor Richard Reardon, pronounced itself satisfied with the new contract.
We got more than half a loaf, but the unions hung tough. They got a good win situation. We got a good win situation. We're going to save an awful lot of money for the bus riders of the county.
MTA board members say they'll offer free bus and train rides for 5 days. Hardly enough compensation for a 32-day strike, said bus rider Janine Nakano.
How about all the time that they've had to try to get to work? How about all the time that kids have missed out on their education? That there's no way that is gonna even compare to what they've lost out on.
The MTA board says it's also considering fare hikes and service cuts. But as bus riders gear up to fight them, they say this time they'll be working with bus drivers that they supported during the 32-day walkout. Meantime, LA's labor conflicts aren't over. County workers continue talks, and LA's teachers have voted to authorize a strike. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Yurovich in Los Angeles.
On Tuesday, the presidential debates returned to St. Louis. In 1992, Democrat Bill Clinton, Republican George Bush, and Reform Party candidate Ross Perot faced off on the banks of the Mississippi. This time around, third-party candidates Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan were shut out. But as Randy McKay reports from St. Louis, there was also an element in this year's debate which was not there in 1992. Protest.
For one person, opening up the debates has become a life-or-death situation. Steve Hamm started a fast on September 30th. He has attended all 3 presidential debates and the vice presidential debate. He thinks a lack of adequate dialogue is a serious threat.
We stand on the threshold of environmental devastation at a level that the average consumer has no idea. The average person has no idea of where we are. And we don't know if we have entered a threshold point or not at this point in time. And so I felt like I had to do something that was really as radical as I could, consistent with my pacifist beliefs.
But risking one's health isn't for everyone. Fortunately, according to Ham, just having the protests is valuable.
I think on a personal level, it's a very important statement by the people who get involved. I think it's at least an initial commitment that they feel that we really need some change, some serious change in this country. In the least, it is a force for education. We're talking about issues now. We're talking about issues more so than I think has ever been done before in the political marketplace. So unfortunately, that's what I think it is.
Though the four protests haven't attracted enough people to change the outcome of the election, they do show a change. And in St. Louis, the protest attracted people of all ages and ethnicities. But the group was primarily white college-age students out to support Ralph Nader, who was again barred from even entering the debates as a spectator. Sarah Bance was one of the 900 protesters. In 1992, when the presidential debates last occurred in St. Louis, she was a student here. She says no one was out protesting that year. But now that they are, she says a change has occurred.
People are understanding the problems on a much more basic level, and the individual issues that they've been dealing with, whether it's the death penalty or police brutality or genetic engineering or whatever it might be, they're realizing the connection between the problems that we're facing and the causes.
She says the election of Bush or Gore will allow those problems to continue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rennie McKay in St. Louis.
While Vice President Al Gore campaigns around the country, one place he's unlikely to stop is the small industrial town of East Liverpool, Ohio, home of the WTI toxic waste incinerator, one of the largest of its kind in the world. In 1992, Gore said he'd stop the plant from operating if he was elected. But as Evan Davis reports from East Liverpool, the incinerator and the memory of Gore's promise still remain.
One of the largest incinerators of toxic and hazardous waste materials in the world, and located in a residential neighborhood just 1,100 feet from an elementary school, WTI was the focus of Gore's 1992 campaign, in which he pledged to prevent the then unfinished plant from becoming operational. Local activist and mother Terry Swearingen remembers that promise.
People take with a grain of salt things that politicians promise during the campaign. It's almost expected that they're not going to keep their word. But when a politician makes a promise, and in this case it was in writing, as a press release by Al Gore, that I think it's taken more seriously because it was the very first environmental issue addressed by the new Clinton-Gore team, and it was the first promise to a community.
Although Al Gore claims it was the previous administration under George Bush Sr. that began the irreversible permit approval process for WTI, evidence has recently come to light that it was Gore himself who gave the green light for the plant to begin operation. Ohio resident and renowned environmental activist Harvey Wasserman confronted Al Gore on this issue at a campaign rally in Columbus.
Gore hemmed and hawed and whined and moaned and complained that the reason that WTI went online after he and Bill Clinton promised it wouldn't, but it had something to do with George Bush Sr. and the Bush administration. And no doubt the Bush administration pushed the thing through, but there is a whole litany of things that the Clinton-Gore administration could have done once they came in power to prevent WTI from going online and from continuing to operate. Clearly they've done nothing of the sort because it's still operating.
Not all East Liverpool residents are concerned about WTI's impact on their community's health and safety. One WTI employee expressed confidence in the facility.
WTI is perfectly legitimate, a fine organization, fine people running it. I invite anyone to tour the facility with me. I will personally bring my wife, my 8-year-old son, and my 15-month-old baby. I will carry through the whole tour. That's how safe I think the facility is.
But residents and others opposed to the plant cite numerous health statistics and violations that paint a different picture. Terry Swearingen.
The citizens were forced to file a lawsuit to try to stop the operation of the facility in federal court. And the whole suit was based on the Federal Hazardous Waste Law, RIGWA, their imminent endangerment provision, which said that if there's a facility that's causing an imminent hazard, that the government could go in and shut it down. Well, we took the company to court, and actually we won that lawsuit. The court ruled that WCI was too dangerous to operate for even 1 year. The reason that the facility is operating is because the company was successful in going to the Court of Appeals, who dismissed the case based on lack of jurisdiction, not on a lack of evidence of the risk.
Well, people have been confronted in this state with a choice between their jobs and their health.
Harvey Wasserman.
WTI spews toxic chemicals all over the Ohio Valley region, and including the elementary school 1,100 feet away. Absolutely no reason for it to operate. There are much better things to do with contamination, chemical waste, than find a way to disseminate them into everybody's lungs. That stuff needs to be buried. It needs to be, well, it needs to be not created in the first place is the crucial thing. And we need industrial processes that don't create toxic waste of the type that's being burned at WTI. But if it exists, the last thing on earth you want to do is to send it up a smokestack and into the general community and disperse it around the environment as widely as possible. That's patently insane, and that's why WTI should never have been built, should not have opened, and should not continue to operate.
For now, Swearingen and the citizens of East Liverpool are waiting on the national EPA to complete its findings and release its report on WTI. Swearingen, who is a featured guest at this weekend's Bioneers Conference in San Francisco, was contacted by the national EPA ombudsman on Wednesday and is expecting to receive a preliminary report of the EPA's findings within a few days. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in East Liverpool, Ohio.
In Seattle, there's been extensive coverage of a regional slump in the dot-com economy, as 17 of the city's publicly held internet companies are running losses, and 4 of them will run out of cash in the next 12 months. But there's been less attention paid to an announcement that one of those money-losing ventures, internet retail giant Amazon.com, has entered a partnership with a customer support company based in New Delhi, India. That company will have hired 150 customer service representatives for Amazon by the end of November. As Martha Baskin reports from Seattle, Amazon's move has raised serious questions about the security of jobs created by the new economy.
While Amazon customer service employees already earn lower wages than unionized customer service employees across the United States, $11 an hour for full-time employees or $1,900 a month for 40 hours a week, prevailing wages for service jobs in India's information technology industry pay the U.S. monthly equivalent of between $109 and $175 U.S. dollars a month. Should Amazon choose, it could rid itself of its financial woes significantly by moving all back-office operations to India directly. That might be attractive, considering that a recent Seattle Times study predicts that if the company continues to operate as it has, it will run out of cash in 8 quarters. A labor alliance in the Puget Sound affiliated with the Communications Workers of America, the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, or WashTech, was tipped off about the company's decision by customer service reps fearful of losing their jobs. WashTech organizer Gretchen Wilson says that although Amazon's customer service reps are confused about what it might mean to be in a union, they still regularly contact the labor alliance with concerns about job security, repetitive stress injuries, mandatory overtime, and what's right and wrong in the workplace.
You know, you could hear from company management that they don't foresee any layoffs in the near future, and that's great, and we actually hope that that's the case. However, until workers have a contract that spells out in writing what their rights are and what they can expect for their employment at the company, they're still at-will employees, and at-will employees in Washington State can be fired for almost any reason. You'd be let go at any time for any reason.
Amazon company spokesperson Margaret Dawson acknowledged it would be unrealistic to say cost was not a factor in the company's decision to form an outsourcing partnership with New Delhi-based Dakish.com.
We are always looking for ways to be the most cost-efficient.
But she concluded,
we're not outsourcing to them to make up for jobs we would have hired here. It is definitely complementary to our current customer service and future, so we will continue to hire in both the United States and in Europe.
Dakish.com is one of many new companies that employ highly skilled, low-wage Indian workers to fill the demand of U.S. companies seeking cheaper options for their customer support needs. An Amazon customer service rep, who asked that their name not be used for fear of retaliation, said it's commonly understood that the company plans to have 8% of all work outsourced in the first year of the partnership and up to 12% the next year. WashTec believes the increase may be as high as 80%, according to inside sources, a figure which was unable to be confirmed. WashTec is careful to not couch its concerns about Seattle jobs being transferred to India in xenophobic terms, but feels Amazon owes something to the community which helped it grow. Again, Gretchen Wilson.
However, what you do have is a situation in which people may have been working for the company for 4 or 5 years. At least, you know, often many of the customer service workers at Amazon have been working there for a couple of years and have been putting in exceptional amounts of time and energy, are completely drained and oftentimes very stressed out of the job, and are working through holidays, working extensive overtime during the holidays, and are putting a lot of energy into this company. And Amazon is not giving any guarantees that by outsourcing to India that these jobs in Seattle are secure.
Labor historian Dana Frank, who teaches at the University of California, Santa Cruz, says that a number of different factors could eventually force Amazon's hand, among them a unionized workforce. Customers who might be disturbed that those representing the company are underpaid workers from India, or a radical change in local and federal trade policy.
Part of our problem is that we don't have national policies that say it's good for capital to stay in the United States. We have national economic policies that say it's good for capital to leave, to go wherever it can seek the highest rate of profit, like a heat-seeking missile, and that leaves the country cold.
Until any of these factors come into play, Amazon.com remains a free agent in the global marketplace. Although it remains unclear whether there is a trend among high-tech companies in Seattle to transfer service and other back-office positions to low-wage regions of the world, the companies that created Silicon Valley, among them Advanced Micro Devices and Hewlett-Packard, have already been shifting employment to low-wage countries since the late 1980s. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
The host of Pacifica Radio's most popular and radical program, Democracy Now!, says management at the nation's largest progressive radio network is trying to gut the program of its political content. In a letter addressed to Pacifica's board of directors, host Amy Goodman called a 3-page memo she received from the network's program director, Stephen Yasko, and its attorney, Larry Drapkin, a crackdown. The memo prescribed a new set of restrictions on her show. Eileen Sutton reports from New York.
According to Goodman's memo, Yasko presented a series of new policies and work rules which Goodman must immediately follow or else face disciplinary action which could include being fired. The new rules include Goodman no longer being allowed to use volunteer producers for her program, labor which she notes is the lifeblood of the Pacifica mission. Every Friday, Goodman must also give Yasko a list of her shows for the upcoming week, along with a short status report on each. According to Goodman's memo, Yasko does not consider Democracy Now! A show which covers breaking news. Under the terms of Yasko's letter, Goodman is now also obligated to get permission and approval from the Pacifica Foundation before she speaks publicly. Goodman's memo documents what she calls a campaign of harassment that she and her staff have been subjected to for several months by Pacifica management. When she tried to file a grievance through her union, Goodman was informed by union officials that management wanted to resolve the conflict amicably. When Goodman arrived for a meeting to discuss the issues, she was instead handed the list of work rules by Yasko. Goodman has since gone forward with a formal grievance. According to Goodman's own words, a darker motive for targeting Democracy Now! May be looming. Goodman links the timing of some of the harassment to the upcoming national elections. She notes that her show has aggressively targeted both parties' conventions, and the program routinely addresses a growing grassroots national movement that fundamentally challenges this country's political status quo. Goodman says these issues are routinely ignored in the corporate press. Goodman is formally asking the National Board to stop what she believes is the attempt by management to both rein in and profoundly change the political content of the network's most popular national program. National Board member Thomas Moran reports that he has sought clarification from both Yasko and Executive Director Bessie Wash regarding Democracy Now!, but that they have failed to respond to his request. Likewise, Free Speech Radio News contacted Wash's office for comment, but the call was not returned. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Eileen Sutton, in New York.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against the Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. To learn more about the strike, check out our website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.